It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a Schwabenon-based Shopko is trying to climb out of bankruptcy, and now more than 1,000 retail workers in Wisconsin will face layoffs. We'll talk about the impact this will have on local economies. First, whether you like it or not, the 2020 presidential campaign is underway, and so is the media coverage. We're seeing early polls coming out, fundraising results, and lots of analysis of the prospect for the Republican incumbent and a growing field of Democratic challengers. Same kind of things you might see in the coverage of any election campaign. But our next guest says when it comes to media coverage of elections, there's a better way. Instead of the so-called horse race reporting, he says journalists should focus on things citizens want to hear candidates talk about. How do they know what those citizens want? Ask them. Jay Rosen joins us now to talk about a citizen's agenda for election coverage. He's a professor of journalism at New York University. Jay, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob.
Well, before we get to the citizen's agenda idea, can you talk about what you see as the problem with the state of the art when it comes to a lot of election coverage and the so-called horse race coverage?
Well, most election coverage is constructed around a horse race model of election journalism, which means that the question is always who's going to win or who's ahead and how are they strategizing for their campaign and what did the latest polls say and what are going to be some of the challenges for them in winning. And while that is a valid subject and is of interest to political professionals and political junkies, it's hard to maintain much of a civic interest in campaigns when they're focused so predictably on what critics like myself call the horse race.
And that brings us to this citizens' agenda. You wrote about this recently, just after last year's elections. You've been talking about this idea for quite a while, though. What is the citizens' agenda for coverage?
Well, it's a different model for campaign coverage in which the starting point is not who's going to win or who's ahead or who are you likely to vote for, but a very simple and powerful question. What do you want the candidates to be discussing as they compete for votes in this year's election? What do you want the candidates to be discussing? And if journalists can get a good answer to that question, which is actually very challenging, you have to ask it in lots of different ways. You have to make sure you're asking lots of people. You have to listen carefully. There's a lot of interpretation required. There's a lot of synthesis. But if you can, in fact, find out what the voters, what your community, your state, in the case of Wisconsin, wants the candidates to be discussing as they compete for votes, then that becomes a kind of template for your campaign coverage that can replace the horse race. And it can tell you what to focus your reporting on. It can tell you what to focus your explainers and explanatory journalism on. And when you have a chance to talk to the candidates themselves, the citizens' agenda tells you what to ask about. It also gives you a goal for your coverage. You have a mission. And the mission is to let voters know as much as you can about what the candidates say on the items that are on the citizens' agenda. So this is not a new idea. It was first practiced in a serious way in 1992, which is several decades ago, in Charlotte, North Carolina. Its pieces of it have been picked up and tried again and again. So it stands there as an alternative to the horse race, and now it's up to journalists to decide to pick it up and use it again.
On a practical level, talk about what it looks like for a news organization to ask that question and get that information. What are the methods that we would use to glean this information from citizens?
Right. Every method known to man is the answer. You would ask people to call you. You would tell people where they can email you. You would use survey methods. You would talk to people one-on-one. You would send reporters out into the community to ask that question. You would attend community events where you can pose that question. You would create events where people can show up and talk to you. You would do focus groups, and you would use old-fashioned polling. And by blitzing the state, with this question. What do you want the candidates to discuss as they compete for votes? You would gradually create a kind of a public awareness that your newsroom is doing this, and the idea would be that you could test your citizens' agenda. You could come to a sort of preliminary read and then find out if it's right by checking it with citizens, with leaders, with academics, with political scientists, with polling, so that you know that you have it right. For example, in the 28 campaign, this kind of happened informally in the sense that reporters out on the trail realized that in many states, the most important issue was not Trump yay or nay, but health care. And that became part of their coverage. So it's a more systematic way of doing exactly that.
Talking to Jay Rosen, professor of journalism at New York University, talking about the idea of a citizen's agenda, a different way to cover political campaigns for president and at other levels. And Jay, I think a lot of times people think of the alternative for horse race coverage as covering, I'll throw air quotes around this, the issues. But if I'm hearing you right, the problem is that if the journalists themselves are defining what the issues are, it's not really that much better.
Yeah, usually the alternative to the horse race is presented as either the issues or sometimes a simple one-word answer, policy. And the problem with that is we still don't know where the issues come from and which policies are to be dug into. And so the citizen's agenda is different. It doesn't start with issues. It starts with people. It starts with the people you plan to inform with your campaign coverage. And so for Wisconsin Public Radio, it would be the people who listen to Wisconsin Public Radio. What do they want the candidates to be discussing as they compete for votes? I think that's an answerable question. And if you can get a good answer to it, not only would you have a template for your campaign coverage, but the candidates themselves couldn't ignore the citizens' agenda because they would know that this is what the voters want them to be discussing.
Yeah, the measure a lot of times of a good candidate and a good campaign is they get the media talking about the issues that they want to be talking about. And for candidate Donald Trump, whether people like him or not, it was clear he was really good at getting the media to talk about the things he wanted to talk about. Is this some insulation against the citizens' agenda, some insulation against the candidates kind of driving the narrative?
Yes. If you are going to hold the line, if you are going to avoid getting sucked into a campaign with stunts and attacks and demagoguery and trickery, then you need something to ground your coverage in. You need to have roots for your coverage that are stronger than the gales and storms and tempests that the 24-hour news cycle brings. And so the citizen's agenda is a way of keeping yourself grounded and not falling for campaign tricks and for distractions. And in order to do that, you have to have an agenda that you can be public with. But it can't be your agenda as editors and journalists. It has to come from the people that you are trying to inform. And so in the citizen's agenda approach, you not only go out and try and find out what do people want the candidates to be discussing as they compete for votes, but once you have a sense of that, you make it public. And it's a constant in your coverage, and you revise it as the campaign moves on. And anyone can go to WisconsinPublicRadio.org and look at it and find out what your campaign coverage priorities are.
Jay Rosen is with us, professor of journalism at New York University. We're talking about media coverage of political campaigns. He's making the case for a citizen's agenda for coverage, where media outlets ask citizens what they want to hear from candidates. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the way media outlets have covered elections past and present? And will ask you the question he wants the journalist to ask citizens. What do you want to hear the candidates talking about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about media coverage of elections with Jay Rosen from New York University. He says news outlets should let citizens help drive their coverage of candidates and campaigns with one simple question: what do you want the candidates to be discussing as they compete for votes? We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea? What do you think about what you see from media coverage of campaigns and politics? And what is your answer to that question? What do you want to hear the 2020 presidential candidates talking about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Frank is with us in La Crosse. Frank, hi.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I think what we need is real people asking real questions and not media stars paid multi-million dollars who don't reflect our reality. The best example I think of that is, I think it's the Showtime series, The Circus, a half-hour weekly show where they follow the campaign and they ask questions, but then they get together and break bread at some fancy restaurant. And it's just amazing that, you know, I'm really more distracted by, you know, where they're eating, what they're eating, than, you know, what they've got to say. The other example, of course, is the national media hosts that are disconnected from reality, too, because, you know, they're paid corporate salaries and they're not really connected with real people. On the other side is Sam, the red vest guy from the 2016 campaign that became a celebrity because he was the common man.
Frank, thanks a lot for the call. Frank saying a lot of the bigger media stars don't represent the public very well.
Well, it's a good point. There's a gap between what voters ask candidates and what journalists want to ask candidates. There shouldn't be such a gap, but there often is. A simple example of it would be, it's very common for political journalists on the campaign trail to bring up polls and say to a candidate, you're fourth in the polls, do you really think you can come back? Right. Which is not a question that would occur to a voter, because who's going to win and who's likely to win is not the first thing on voters' minds. Now, it still is important in the sense that people want to know if the person they're voting for has a chance. And so it's not like we should ban that topic from consideration, but it's not rich enough, it's not important enough to base your campaign coverage around it. And the journalist's interest in who's up, who's down, what the latest polls say, who's likely to win, can you come back, those are things that if you give the microphone to voters, they don't ask about that.
Thanks a lot for the call, Frank. We'll get out to Marnie in Madison. Marnie, hello.
Hi. I am very high and keen on this idea of a citizen's agenda. I just want to say that I think it would be impossible to overestimate the degree of ennui and despair that a typical, maybe I shouldn't speak for typical voters, but that voters feel at the lack of substance and the manipulation of the media in these horse races. If you did nothing else, if they did nothing else, then to stop covering the horse race, we would be, you know, miles ahead of where we are now, because would force at least some talk other than, as your guest is saying, who's ahead.
Marnie, thanks a lot for that call. Jay, do you think there's an audience appetite to get this kind of coverage? Would people feel relieved to move away from the horse race to this kind of coverage?
Well, I think the idea of the citizens' agenda is precisely to find out what people want their election campaigns to be about. That is the starting point for this approach. So unless they're lying to you or making up answers, one would think that a campaign coverage approach built around answers to that question would be of interest to people. But we don't really know until we see a good faith effort to do it. It's true, however, that when you ask horse race journalists why they do it that way, They often defend it or explain it by saying it makes the campaign interesting. This is what people want. This is what creates viewer interest in the campaign. It's a show. It's a race. A race is very easy to understand. Who's ahead creates suspense. These are the kinds of rationalizations that they offer.
Thanks for the call, Marnie. We're talking to Jay Rosen from New York University, talking about political campaign coverage in the media. He says, let's move away from horse race coverage and embrace a citizen's agenda. Try to have coverage generated by ideas, by policies that the people want to hear about from their candidates. Gary joins us now in Iron River. Gary, hi.
Hi, good afternoon, guys. So this citizen's agenda is a discussion about how the candidates and how the journalists can help the candidates discuss how they're going to make government more efficient, how they're going to do more with less, how they're going to instill competition that exists in the private industry. All we ever hear about is we're going to spend more money on this, more money on that, and we just keep taking bigger and bigger amounts of taxes without any driver of efficiency, because we have no alternate provider except governments for so many of these services.
Gary, thanks a lot for the call. So Gary saying what he wants to hear candidates talking about. So if I'm a news editor, an assignment editor, Jay, I've got lots of examples of people like Gary and others giving their own agenda items. How do I sort that out and actually turn it into coverage?
Well, once we start hearing this again and again, we know something's up, right? So we have to take what we're hearing, which is going to be phrased slightly differently by each person, like Gary, and ask ourselves, what's the essential heart of that conversation? So it might be something like, how do we make government more efficient? Or what can government learn from the private sector? And if you hear that again and again, it means that is tapping into something that the state of Wisconsin wants to hear the candidates talk about. And that becomes an item on the citizens' agenda. And so that is how the process works, is you listen carefully to what people are saying, you frame it so that it captures what you have heard, and then you rank and order the conversation from the thing that most people want to hear about to others in the top 10 or 8 or 12. And there's quite a bit of interpretation and synthesis involved in that. So it's a journalistic act, but it has to be accurate to what people have told you.
If I'm a campaign manager or a lobbying group, can I game this? Can I say, hey, I'm going to email all my followers, call the paper, here's their hotline, tell them that you're interested in these issues?
You could game it if there was one method, then we were relying strictly on that, like call in. But if you have enough methods, it becomes very difficult to game, and you have to validate this final product with survey research or polling that draws from a random sample, and so it's very hard to game that.
Let's go back to our callers. Mitch is with us in Plover. Mitch, hello.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, what'd you want to bring up, Mitch?
I wanted to kind of get your gauge on how the citizens' agenda would kind of steer the negativity we constantly hear during these campaigns. It's never about what the certain candidate's going to do for us. It's always about how bad the other candidate is going to be for us. And we end up choosing between the lesser of two evils versus picking a candidate that we can actually support things on. And I'm curious how a citizen's agenda would help steer that type of conversation.
Interesting. Mitch, what do you think, Jay?
Well, it goes like this. Senator Klobuchar, how do we make the federal government more efficient? And if her answer is an attack on President Trump, the follow-up question is, well, that's very nice, but how do we make government more efficient? In other words, you're persistent. You just keep asking. And many newspapers and public radio stations have taken to providing voters guides during election season in which they explain what the issues are and where the candidates stand on them. And part of the citizens' agenda approach is we are producing here a better voters guide so that we can tell you with really good detail exactly what the candidates say on the issues that most people care about. And just by continuing to return to those things instead of focusing on attacks, you can hopefully change the tone of the campaign.
Thanks for that call, Mitch. Jay, how do we get there from where we are now to actually have the citizens' agenda be the norm in American journalism?
Well, I'm very interested in that question. I'm going to hopefully be working on it, but it really takes one news organization and then another to say, we're going to change our approach, and this year we're going to try something different. You have to help us. Here's what it is. That's the way we're going to do it. And it's not going to start, I can guarantee you, from New York and Washington and from the NBCs and Washington Post and New York Times of the World. It's going to start in regional and local journalism with editors and executive producers who are themselves fed up with the traditional way of doing things.
And in our last minute, most people listening right now are not journalists. What would you say to them if they want to see this kind of change from their public or private media outlets?
You have to speak up. You have to use the existing channels you have to talk to your news providers and tell them, don't go back to the horse race. We've done that. It hasn't helped us. Our politics are pretty much in ruin. Let's try something different.
Jay, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You are so welcome. Thanks, Rob.
That's Jay Rosen, professor of journalism at New York University. He joined us to make the case for a citizens' agenda for media coverage of elections. You can find a link to some of his writing about this at WPR.org. Go to the Central Time page there. We've got a link on the segment note for today. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about what big Shopko layoffs around the state will mean for local economies in Wisconsin and what kind of job retraining prospects are out there for workers who are being laid off. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. The Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Tony Evers became the third governor to pull National Guard troops from the southern border. We'll find out what the Guard has been doing there and why those governors are bringing them back home. First, Shopko filed for bankruptcy last month, and the number of stores they plan to close around the country now totals more than 250. 42 of those stores are located in Wisconsin. According to new numbers from the company, this month it'll mean layoffs for more than 1,000 workers around the state. Stephen Deller is a professor with UW-Madison's Agricultural and Applied Economics Program. He researches economic growth and community economic development. Steve, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
Well, the Department of Workforce Development Secretary Caleb Frostman said in a statement after these layoffs were announced that these closures would, quoting here, undoubtedly change the fabric of multiple Wisconsin communities. Four smaller towns where Shopko might have been the only thing like a department store, how big an impact does this have?
That can actually be a fairly large, because one, it's the shopping opportunities, but also you end up with these abandoned kind of white elephants that are sitting in the community, and that can kind of give a visualization that the community's kind of not doing very well. So not only is it a kind of an economic impact in terms of less shopping opportunities, but it's also kind of a moral impact that now you've got this vacant store that's sitting right there.
And we hear concerns in smaller communities, okay, the grocery store that used to be there isn't there anymore. You have to drive out of town to do that. With each local amenity that isn't there, it seems like a big hurdle to getting people to move into or stay in a community.
Well, it's also creating opportunities, because one of the things that's happening with retail is that we're seeing the growth in more especially niche type smaller stores. So when you see the big box stores like a Shopko go out, it actually creates some opportunities in those local communities if they're willing to kind of explore that and check it out.
Now, if we had 1,000 people at one factory in one town, this would be a big story there. This is more spread out around the state. But can you talk about the economic impact of layoffs now of Shopko workers at these stores that are closing?
Well, you have to realize that a lot of the jobs that are at Shopko are not the higher-end paying jobs. You'll have managers and assistant managers that are making fairly good wages. But a lot of the jobs in retail are clerical, janitorial, and they're not that high of a paying job. Now, that doesn't mean that it's not hard for the individual family that's being affected. It can be devastating to the individual family, but from a larger economic impact perspective, it's not as large as if you had a manufacturing firm that was paying, you know, high wages.
For people, these are stores, some in more urban areas, rural areas, all points in between. And is that a different story depending on where you are if you're now out of a job and looking for maybe another retail job?
That's exactly true. In urban areas, of course, you have greater opportunities to find other sources of employment. In rural areas, it's a little bit more difficult. But one of the things that we're finding, a colleague of mine, Matt Kears, in the Center for Community Economic Development, is looking at commuting patterns. And one of the things that Matt's finding is that people are willing to commute much greater distances for employment. So what's happening is that you may lose those employment opportunities within the community, but people are willing to travel greater distances to find employment.
I've heard of more communities becoming kind of bedroom communities, they call them, where I live here, I'm 20, 30 minutes outside of Milwaukee, Madison, Green Bay, whatever it is. I'm happy to commute there. I'll accept that I have to go there maybe to do a lot of the shopping I want to do. Is this the wave of the future?
I think it is. And I think that that's where, you know, all bedroom communities are not a desert of employment opportunities. When you see a lot of bedroom communities, you do see a lot of smaller specialty type stores that are starting to pop up. And what they're doing is that they don't need a large customer base because they're smaller, they're more specialized. So you will see these kind of opportunities present themselves in these communities.
Talking to Stephen Deller from UW-Madison's Agricultural and Applied Economics Program, looking at the impact of Shopko filing for bankruptcy, announcing the closure of stores around the country, a little over 40 of those here in Wisconsin. Steve, the state has various kinds of retraining programs when there are larger layoffs. Is that something that would kick in here with the Shopko employees?
I think that that's true. I think there's really kind of two strategies. One is kind of the longer-term strategy, the community. How are they going to respond? Should they respond? How does this create business opportunities for local folks? But the shorter term is trying to help these families adjust to being unemployed. And you know, what kind of services can they tap into? So there's a short-term kind of focus on the families, and then there's the longer term in terms of the community trying to adapt to it. The effectiveness of these worker retraining programs really hinges on the local labor market and what the types of jobs that are being generated. Too often, we kind of say, well, there's a state need for welders, so we're going to train all these welders. Well, they're all located in one or two places, and it's not a good match.
Now, we talk about Shopko as compared to other retail stores, maybe a little more here, because it's a company that was born in Wisconsin. Is there, I don't know, a morale effect when this sort of homegrown business is running into trouble?
That's always true, but you have to realize that Shopko is a national company, and it is facing the same type of pressures that, say, Sears and Kmart are facing. There's a changing way in which we spend our money in retail, and the Shopkos of the world, the Sears of the world, are having a very difficult time adapting to that.
Does it hurt a local community if more of the shopping is going online to Amazon or whatever alternatives to Amazon are out there versus that big box store by the highway?
It is, because the employment is not associated locally. But, you know, the amount of online shopping, I mean, it has gone up. I mean, in 2015, it was estimated that just over 7% of all retail was online. In 2018, it's about 10%. So there is an upward trend in that. But it's not, I don't think that Shopko and the Searses of the world are suffering because of Amazon. I think it's other market forces that are at play. Online shopping doesn't help, but it is there are other forces at play.
What are some of those?
I think part of it's the way the consumer, you're kind of seeing a growth in deep discount type stores, Walmart, dollar stores. Dollar General is just a company that's booming. And then there's a growth in kind of the higher end discount stores, if that's a phrase. Think Target, those types of stores. And you're also seeing growth in kind of specialty stores, niche type of stores, and then the online. So this market that Sears kind of went after and Shopko kind of went after is kind of, it's being pulled apart a little bit. And I think those are some of the larger forces.
Now, if, say, a local economic development official came to you, Steve, and your colleagues and said, okay, Shopko's closing, we're losing some jobs, we want to get ourselves ready for the future, replace those jobs somehow, what kind of strategies would you point them toward?
I would look at downtown. The immediate reaction will be to try to find something to go into that existing facility. And there are some communities that have found successful uses for it. A lot of times it's shifting away from retail. It's towards warehousing or something, some other type of use other than retail. But first thing I would do is look downtown. Look at the businesses that are in downtown and the potential market opportunities that are being created by that Shopko not being there now.
Right. The trend for years and years is the downtown is hurt by the mall or the Target that's hurting the mall or whatever. And there's that idea that there's a prejudice. Americans don't want to drive to places that don't have vast amounts of surface parking. Is that something that a local community can overcome?
I think that's the niche. That's the kind of the return. There's almost a pushback against going towards the big shopping malls. You will still see, folks that are saying, okay, well, we're going to make a trip into town. We're going to go to the mall and because we've got multiple things that we need to purchase. But increasingly, we're seeing more customers preferring to go to kind of downtown businesses. I don't really want to go to the mall and fight the traffic and fight the crowds in order to buy a pair of shoes. I would rather go to a locally owned business that's downtown. And that's creating opportunities.
As we wrap up, are there things that towns of various sizes can do to build resiliency for when the next business closes, whether it's a retail chain store or, say, a small factory, whatever it might be?
Well, the one thing that communities need to realize is that they cannot become overdependent on one employer. They need to have a more diversified type of economic base so that if they do have one business that goes under, they can kind of absorb that and be resilient. It's the communities that are really kind of hinging on one industry, one company, one business. Those are the communities that are really at risk, and they need to think about how are they going to diversify away from that.
Stephen, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Stephen Deller with UW-Madison School of Agricultural and Applied Economics with us to talk about the local impact of Shopko's announced layoffs. Those will affect more than 1,000 employees in Wisconsin starting in May. Coming up, we'll look at Governor Evers' decision to withdraw Wisconsin National Guard troops from the U.S.-Mexico border. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, proposals to slash lawmaker pay or cut off congressional paychecks during government shutdowns seem to be popular with the public, but would they make government more effective and efficient? We hear the case against these kinds of proposals, including a new effort to eliminate pensions for retiring members of Congress. First, Governor Evers says there's no evidence of a security crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border, so there's no reason for Wisconsin's National Guard troops to be there. He issued an executive order yesterday withdrawing the soldiers from the area. That move reverses a decision by then-Governor Walker, who sent the troops to Arizona last summer to help secure the border. A member of the Wisconsin National Guard, Illinois Congressman Adam Kinzinger, criticized Evers on Fox News yesterday.
I'm curious if the governor of Wisconsin ever bothered to go down and see what his men and women were doing in the border to support Border Patrol and to protect the Wisconsin community. Because when I was there, he never showed up. He never showed up, and he would have seen the drugs that we took off the street. He would have seen the people that we rescued in the desert. And he would have seen his helicopters moving Border Patrol into rough areas to apprehend people that otherwise they would have to walk 2 or 3 miles in.
In addition to Evers, the governors of New Mexico and California have also announced that they're bringing some or all of their Guard members back home. Terrence Garrett is a professor of public affairs and security studies at the University of Texas Rio Grande Valley in Brownsville. He also served in the Oklahoma Army and Air National Guard. Terrence, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure, glad to be here.
What kind of duties are National Guard members from states around the country carrying out along the border?
Well, largely it's support. I mean, because of the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878, it circumscribes what they can do as a result of federal troop involvement in Reconstruction and ending Reconstruction. So the idea or the principle is that unless authorized under various titles, Title 10 particularly, where there's a direct threat, it's just not likely that any federal troops, and even National Guard troops, for that matter, can really conduct any sort of apprehension or do anything other than surveillance and support. So,
but does that surveillance and support with the troops there make a difference for the people who can do those jobs? Are they freeing up Border Patrol agents, for example, to do those more of those apprehensions?
Well, I mean, in terms of apprehensions, I mean, if you look at the number of apprehensions, I mean, we're in a 300,000 to 400,000 range as compared to 2000 when it was 1.6 million. I mean, if you look at that in terms of annual figures, there's just simply no way that it even compares. I mean, we're talking about an 83% drop in terms of apprehensions from 2000 to like 2018, where we have the most recent data. So the fact of the matter is that the trend has been downward since 2000. So to say that there's an emergency is really a hard sell.
Right. You've made the case elsewhere, I think, that the calling up of National Guard troops to the border is, in a way, a way to build up support for a wall. Can you talk about that?
Yes. One of the things, certainly, I mean, it's actually said directly by President Trump, both publicly and in his tweets, that in effect that he's going to use the troops. I mean, there are 5,200 federal troops that were here along the border from about October through December, and then they were sent back. They did manage to lay some concertina wire, which really gives sort of a good sort of theatrical or effect. I mean, if you already have a wall and you go to points of entry and you put barbed wire or concertina wire around the fence, it's sort of, it leaves sort of a picture that somehow that we're desperate or in need of further wall building. I think that and the 2,000 or so National Guard troops that have been sent down from fiscal year 2017, effectively, he's trying to demonstrate that there's a need for more infrastructure and by sending troops down to the area. But the problem is, out of 19,500 Border Patrol, about 18,000 of those are on the U.S.-Mexico border, and that's double the number that, since 2001. So really, in effect, in terms of surveillance, in terms of number of boots on the ground, and we already have 670 miles or so of border fence in place in strategic areas, effectively we've got the border pretty much covered. And you can see that based on the number of apprehensions, and in fact the numbers are going down.
Talking to Terrence Garrett, professor of public affairs and security studies at the University of Texas Rio Grande Valley in Brownsville, talking about the use of National Guard troops at the U.S.-Mexico border as Governor Evers says he's bringing Wisconsin's National Guard members home from that duty. He wrote in a statement that he did not see, there does not exist a national security crisis at our southwestern border. Therefore, no justification, he says, for the ongoing presence of the Wisconsin National Guard there. Terrence, how much precedent is there for using National Guard troops at the border? This has been done before the Trump administration, is that right?
Oh, yes. It's been done by previous administrations. It goes a long ways back. But in most instances, I mean, we're talking about a real emergency where you have actually had a surge. Like, for example, I mean, dealing with the numbers I mentioned previously at 1.6 million plus, that was deemed an emergency, and we sent troops down before under the Bush administration. So, I mean, there was a precedent for that, but the numbers simply just don't comport with those numbers, I mean, by any means. And we certainly, since 2000, we've had a lot more infrastructure put in place. I've been down here and watched the border fence in the Rio Grande Valley, about 110 miles or so, put in the 2006 to 2009 time frame. And the problem with the border wall is that it in Texas, most of the land is privately owned. So in the first building of the fence down here in this area, we're talking about 400 private tracts of land, resulting in addition to the $7.5 million per mile cost, court costs of about $72 million because there were 320 cases brought, eminent domain cases. So most people don't realize that the Secure Fence Act and the Real ID Acts of 2005-2006, respectively, allow the government to condemn property. And however, the Fifth Amendment makes it to where individuals have to get a fair market price. And what's been shown previously is that the federal government didn't really, in many cases, give the landowner the proper due that they were supposed to have in terms of money that they were supposed to have gotten for their property taken. So what has happened is also, if you look at the amount of surveillance, I mean, you can go over to South Padre Island, for example, which is a resort area, and it's not actually anywhere on a border, although it is near Boca Chica Beach, which is on the border, and you see a what's called a tethered aerostat reconnaissance system, or TARS, and it's like a blimp with sophisticated surveillance equipment, and we have these arrayed all along the border from Yuma, Arizona, all the way down to here, and they can see a 500-mile radius surveillance, and they're pretty accurate. In addition, you've got tethered drones, you've got towers, you've got sensors. And that's in addition to the, as I previously mentioned, the 18,000 permanent Border Patrol agents just on the southern border.
In our last minute and a half or so, if there were one change, one investment that the U.S. could make at the border to, you know, expedite claims of asylum in a fast and humane manner, or keep drugs out of the country, keep criminals from entering the country illegally, what big change or small change for that matter would you want to see made?
Well, okay, so I was asked to testify at the U.S. Senate Governmental Affairs and Homeland Security Committee in April for 2017, and I was asked that question by Senator Daines, and towards the end of the, he said, "Dr. Garrett, what should the United States do?" And I said, "I think we know what to do. What we need to do is stop the destabilization that's occurring primarily now in the Central American countries of El Salvador, Honduras, and Nicaragua, because that's where most of the migrants are coming from, and refugees. So, and part of that is, you mentioned drug trafficking, human trafficking. The drug trafficking, the impetus for that is U.S. drug consumption. So if you take that impetus away, then you'll see less you'll take the incentive, economic incentive, away from these drug traffickers. And that also leads into other diversification by these criminal organizations into human trafficking, mineral theft, petrochemical theft, all throughout the region south of the United States. So that's what I said in at the Senate. And then what was interesting, your Senator Ron Johnson, who was the chair of the committee, actually agreed with what I said. And he also said that John Kelly, just prior to this, the hearing, said effectively what I said. So once again, we know what we need to do, and that is to stop, you know, the leaks at the border and start doing something in terms of having a comprehensive hemispheric policy.
Terrence, thanks a lot for joining us today. That was Terrence Garrett, professor of public affairs and security studies at the University of Texas Rio Grande Valley in Brownsville. We talked to him about the decisions by Tony Evers and two other governors to start withdrawing National Guard troops from the U.S.-Mexico border, and some of the latest news at the border and efforts to stop the flow of drugs there. As always, you can share your thoughts. Tweet us at Central Time WPR.
I am not throwing away my shot. I am not throwing away my shot. Hey, yo, I'm just like my country. I'm young, scrappy, and hungry, and I'm not throwing away my shot. I'ma get a scholarship.
That's the super hit musical Hamilton there. A lot of people like the music and listen to it over and over, but some people have hit a breaking point and never want to hear it again. As reported by the CBC, there's been an online backlash against Hamilton from Starbucks employees. According to some anonymous employee complaints on various web forums, they have a set of approved musical playlists that includes Hamilton, and they've heard the entire musical on shuffle again and again and again, starting to become a burr in their saddles. The CBC quotes a neurologist saying that in that kind of situation, music can be really hard for the human brain to tune out. I have personal experience. I, a long time ago, worked in a mall at a retail store through multiple holiday seasons. So you see where that's going. You hear the same Christmas songs again and again and again. At least there's more variety of them. But my breaking point, I think, was at the fifth different version of Silver Bells. That put me over the top. And I admit, I'm now pretty grinchy when it comes to holiday music season. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.